So it's beautiful out. The good news about New Jersey, all these things opening up is amazing. So what a great day to, sit with Heather and recalibrate and review, kind of see where this tumultuous year has taken us. So yeah, I'm so excited to be here. My name is Lisa Hamm. I am the chair of the Women's Leadership Alliance for the PIA of New Jersey. I'm the president of the Clyde Paul Agency. It's my pleasure to welcome you all today. We have the very special opportunity to not only all get together virtually and discuss with our PIA New Jersey group, but I don't know if you can see in the left-hand corner yet, but Heather Hansen is with us, the author of the book that we all reviewed here, The Elegant Warrior. So great opportunity today to connect virtually. And then this is a two-part series that we're kicking off today. So with all the good news, hopefully our second part of our series will be reviewing Heather's new book that's coming out, Advocate to Win, in person in September together in a live networking event as we head out of COVID. So that's the goal. But today we'll, you know, enjoy kicking off our first part of the series. Before we begin, this year has been quite a year, and I don't think the Women's Leadership Alliance has missed a step. And that's really because of the committee that we work with. So I want to thank everyone on the Women's Leadership Alliance Committee for all of their time and effort to make this event happen. Specifically, Maria Escalona, she had attended an event with Heather before and suggested this event, which I'm sure afterwards you will all be thanking Maria as well. So thank you, Maria. Let's see. Also our sponsors, of course. So I think you can see on your screen, hopefully, but none of this is possible without our sponsors. So thank you so much to our platinum level sponsor, Franklin Mutual, our gold level sponsor, Plymouth Rock, silver level sponsor, Wright Flood, and our bronze level sponsor, United Fire Group. So this is not possible without you guys. And really thank you for supporting the Women's Leadership Alliance. All right, so how is this gonna go? Jill, how many people do we have on this call? I think we have at least 60 people. So there's quite a few of us.
Yeah, we're still waiting on a few people, but yeah, we had about 82 people sign up.
Okay, so this is meant to be an interactive conversation, which is really exciting. A little bit challenging over Zoom. So I think we're all experts though. It's May of, you know, we've been at this for a while. So just introduce yourself in the chat. You can raise your hand to ask questions once Heather kind of kicks off our event. So to raise your hand electronically, you're gonna hit Alt Y and that will raise your hand. So for me right now, you can see I raised my hand and Alt Y will unraise your hand. So when the time comes, it's meant to be discussion with Heather about kind of how she, you know, came up with the book, her actual trials in the courtroom and in real life and how we can all learn from them. So raise your hand, ask your questions. And if you feel more comfortable putting your question in the chat box, that's fine too. So Jill will be monitoring both of those areas. All right, so without any much more, in planning today's event, I had the chance to speak with Heather before, you know, before we are all going to today. And I'll tell you that her real life trials and tribulations from the courtroom trials and real life parallel so closely to what we do in insurance. So we're really lucky to have her. And for those of you who haven't read the book, I'm gonna give a quick little summary, but you know, it's so brief. If you checked out her website, she has done so much more than this. But in summary, Heather comes from a background of many years as a trial lawyer. She's defended medical malpractice cases for over 20 years, was recently inducted into the American College of Trial Lawyers. She's consistently named one of the top 50 female attorneys in the state of Pennsylvania. She works as a communication consultant, combining her courtroom experience and her psychology degree as a trained as a mediator to help her clients. She's appeared on CNN, NBC, Fox News, Good Day Philadelphia, and is the host of Elegant Warrior podcast. So I think that kind of summarizes everything up. So without further ado, I give you Heather Hansen, and I couldn't be more excited. So thank you, Heather, for joining us.
Oh my gosh, Lisa, it is so my pleasure. I love speaking to groups of women like this. I'm so grateful to Maria for introducing me to you guys. And I really want to make this interactive. I'll talk for a couple of minutes to like warm you up, but my hope is, and I could talk the whole time, so if I have to, I will. But my hope is really that you will raise your hands or interact on the chat and let me know where you want to be an elegant warrior. Which tools in the book do you think you want more of an explanation on? What do you want some coaching on? I'll talk a little bit about my next book too. It's funny because the next book comes out in a week. And so that one's really fresh in my mind. So you might hear me sort of refer to some of the things in that book as well. But what I want to start off by doing is sort of describing why the book is the first book was called The Elegant Warrior, because that's a question that I often receive. And the answer to that is a story. As Lisa said, I have been a medical malpractice defense attorney for over 20 years. That means that I represent doctors when their patients sue them. And I've loved it. It's also very challenging. Oftentimes patients are catastrophically injured, and that's why they're suing their doctors. And, you know, in this particular case, the patient who sued the doctor was a young man who had cystic fibrosis. And the cystic fibrosis caused him to have pain and anxiety, and the pain and anxiety caused him to have more anxiety. And it was like this never-ending cycle. He came to the hospital and saw my doctor, who was a hospitalist. And he claimed in his lawsuit that he told my doctor that he was taking X amount of anti-anxiety medication, and that my doctor didn't give him X amount of anti-anxiety medication. And had my doctor given it to him, he wouldn't have had the withdrawal seizure that he had and that broke 5 of his vertebrae. Now, my doctor, when I met with him, said that the patient told me what he was taking, and that's exactly what I put in the record, and that's exactly what I gave him. So it was really sort of a he said, and we had to take the patient's deposition. Depositions are my opportunity to ask all of the questions that I want to ask before trial, so I can ask very specific questions at trial. And when we got to the deposition of this case, I do think it's important to note, this isn't something I mentioned in the book, but I was the only woman in the room. So the court reporter happened to be a male. Oftentimes that's the only other woman in the room with me, but the patient himself was a man. His attorney was a man. I was there without my client. There was an attorney for the hospital, also a man. And during the deposition, the patient was super anxious, in pain, and he kept running to the bathroom. And I was able to get like half a question out and he'd run to the bathroom. And we couldn't get through the deposition. Within minutes, we had to end it because we weren't getting anything done. So we decided to come back about 2 weeks later. We come back about 2 weeks later, same crew in the room. And again, the patient is in pain and suffering from anxiety and running to the bathroom. But I knew that I had to get these answers to prepare my case. And so I bent over and looked the man in the eye and said, "What can I do to help you? How can we make this deposition happen?" And he said, "Oh, these boots that I have on, they're so hot and uncomfortable." He was wearing those big yellow Timberland boots with the thick laces. And he said, "If I didn't have these boots on, I feel like I could get through it." So I looked around at the men who just sat there looking at me, and I was like, "I can take care of this." So I got down on my hands and knees, and he pushed and I pulled, and off popped his shoes, and we were able to get through his deposition. And I was able to ask him the questions I needed to ask him. And when I did, I recognized that the story he was telling me was very different than the story that my doctor had told. It was also very different from the story that the nurses had told about what the patient told them. It was different than what the doctor and the nurses had documented in the medical record. It was different than what he had told other people who documented it in their records. And so I knew we were going to be going to trial, because I believed that my doctor was telling the truth as he remembered it and as documented. So when the time for trial came, I was ready for trial. And on the day that the patient was to testify, I was prepping. And it was right before, during the lunch break, that he was going to go on to be cross-examined by me. So I'm getting ready and writing down all my notes and moving things around. And he came over to me right before he was about to get on the stand. And he said, and he came over with his mom. And he said, "Mom, this is that nice lady I told you about, the one who was so kind to me when I was in so much pain." And his mom gave me a great big hug. And she said, "Thank you so much for being so kind to my son in his moment of weakness." And then her son took the stand. Now, we lawyers call the rooms where we prepare for trial war rooms. We call the stories that we tell about our trials war stories. And I am a warrior in the courtroom. I have a job to do and I have a client to fight for. And so I did. I asked him questions and showed the jury where his answers contradicted the answers he gave in his deposition. And they contradicted the doctor's testimony and the nurse's testimony and the medical records. And as I was questioning him, I was reading the jury's body language. They were leaning forward and nodding at me when I would ask questions. They were leaning back and crossing their arms when he would answer the questions. And by the end of my cross-examination, I knew that I had won that trial. And yet, I went to my car and I cried. Because who was I? Was I the elegant, compassionate woman who got down on her hands and knees to help a man who was in pain? Or was I the warrior who went in for the kill in the courtroom? And who did I want to be? That was probably the moment when I decided that it was time for me to pursue a different career, that I had spent enough years looking for trials, looking for wars, and that I had to start advocating for myself in order to find some new things that I might want to do with my career. And I did. As a result, thereafter, I started doing television, I started doing my podcast, I started writing books. Now I'm a consultant, I do training, I do coaching. But I think we all have those moments where we're not quite sure if we're meant to be elegant or meant to be the warrior. And ideally, you can ride that line down the middle perfectly. But a lot of times, things get rough and we struggle with that. And the tools in The Elegant Warrior are meant to help you when things get tough, to choose your elegance even when you have to be a warrior. And I know for you guys in insurance, that happens a lot. You know, insurance is one of those high emotion professions. You know, people get emotional about the things that they need insurance for. They get emotional about the things that happen that lead to an insurance claim being brought. And I know that you deal with people who can be difficult, and you deal with emotions that can be difficult. And so my hope is that in talking about the book and reading the book, that you will have some tools at your disposal so that you can lean towards elegance a little bit more often. Now with that, I would love to answer any questions that you guys have. I can talk more about some of the stories in the book, some of the most popular stories in the book. The book came out in 2019. So I've actually had the opportunity to talk to a lot of people about that book. And I'm happy to share with you. Oh, good. Ariel, I see your hand. Let's see what you got for me.
Yes, thank you so much. I loved your book. My question, which I have written down, is I don't know if it's this case, but what experience or what moved you to write this book? And was it something that you did instantly, like you thought of it and said, okay, I want to put it on paper? Or was it something that took time to, like, you know, back and forth of should I write this, should I not? Like, and if you could elaborate on that.
It's a great question. So I love to read. I'm a voracious reader, and I always knew I wanted to write a book. I wanted to have a book on the bookstore shelves. I wanted it to be a physical book too, because when I wrote the book, there was the option of just doing it on Kindle, which is fine, but I knew I wanted a physical book. And I actually have started, and one day we'll probably go back to a fiction book, sort of like Bridget Jones Meets the Firm type of book. And so I had started that book. And then when that event happened, and when I decided that I wanted to make this change in my career, the ideas for The Elegant Warrior came to me. Now it took a couple of different iterations. Initially, it was meant to be a book all about questions, because questions are the tools that we use to win. In The Elegant Warrior, you see that there's a chapter on being curious, and there's a chapter on the power of questions, and they sort of are similar. In the next book, it's got 10 tools of an advocate and how to use them to win. There's a whole chapter on questions. So the first sort of draft of the book was a book about questions, and it just wasn't resonating with me. And then as I started just sort of writing down some of the stories that I had had, I also have a psychology degree. So I sort of applied those to life as life lessons. And from there, it flowed pretty easily. I think for any of you that are interested in writing, a lot of people ask me questions about being an author. The advice I get from people like Anne Lamott in her book about writing, Stephen King in his book about writing, Stephen Pressfield in his book about writing, they all pretty much say the same thing, which is, it's not fun, but sit your butt in the chair for a certain amount of time every day and write. And that's how you write a book. And that's how I wrote the first book. And then during COVID, that's how I wrote the second book.
Nice. Thank you. And I'm interested in writing a book. So that advice is like, I'm scared because I'm not a writer. And I'm like, but I have things and testimonies to share, but I don't know what to do.
Ariel, if you write, you are a writer. I can't say that strongly enough. I wasn't a writer. I mean, I wrote, we all write every day, right? But I wasn't a writer. And the great thing today is, you know, it used to be that if you weren't famous or chosen by an agent, then you couldn't get a book published. But these days, there are so many ways to get a book published. So if you are called to write, then I think that that is the muse talking to you, and you have an obligation to listen and to write. So I really hope you do. I really hope you do.
Thank you.
I do see there's a, I don't see a hand up, but I see in the chat from Maria. She says, after every chapter resonates with me, one of my favorites is chapter one, don't just complain, move. If you want things to change, you have to use your voice and look to ways to make changes in an elegant warrior way. Yeah, the first chapter, I mean, gosh, as an early lawyer, sitting in those rooms with complaints just piled up in front of me, I knew that there had to be more than this, right? If I just sat every day looking at complaints, nothing was going to happen. And so that's an example of where you just sort of apply that to life and see where, you know, if it doesn't work in the courtroom to just stay with complaints, how could it work outside the courtroom? Probably not so well. So that's why it began that way. The book also takes the, for the most part, follows the progression of a trial. And the first thing that we get in our cases is the complaint. Does anybody else have questions? If not, I will tell you another story. Oh, good. Nikki.
Hi, thank you for speaking. I got the book right here. yeah, thank you for taking the time. But so you're a great lawyer and everything, and you had a great positive outlook on all your experience. But was there ever a moment that you were like, I should not have done this, or it was just like so overwhelming?
Well, yeah. I mean, are you asking about being a lawyer or writing the book? Because I had that moment for both.
Oh, then both.
So being a lawyer, that took a long time for me to feel that way, which is kind of weird, right? Like I started sort of naive enough to think I could win every case and ready to box it out. And I had a lot of vim and vigor. One of my doctors, you guys might be familiar with Rothman Orthopedics. It's a big group based in Pennsylvania, but they're in Jersey as well. So Dr. Rothman has become a mentor and a friend. And he once said that he wanted me to represent Rothman Orthopedics at a very young age because I had a fire in my belly. That's what he said. And I did. And so in that endeavor, that feeling of like, I don't want to do this anymore, or what have I done, or what am I doing, didn't come until probably 20 years, well, let's be 10 years after practice. And after 10 years of practice in a job where there's a winner and a loser, and it's public, you know, so like politics and sports are really the other jobs like that, I got tired of fighting every day. And I got tired of like almost every day getting yelled at. And I got tired of the masculine energy. You know, it's mostly men in that field. I do think it would be great if more women entered the field. It's also a very difficult field for women because when you're on trial, you have no control over your schedule whatsoever. And if you have kids, which I don't, then it's really hard. But so it was around 2008 when I was like, I don't know if I want to do this forever. And then it took me another, I don't know. I mean, I'd say 10 years to sort of step into a different role and start doing the things that I'm now doing. I always say, you know, people say leap and the net will appear, but I didn't leap. I was creeping. Like I took little steps to doing television, and I took little steps to writing the book, and I took little steps to doing the podcast, but that worked for me and gave me the security and the stories that I could sort of fall back on. Now, as far as the book is concerned and the work that I've done, even the next book too. So the next book comes out a week from today, and it's the same exact feeling. It is like, holy crap, all that work that I did is now going to be out in the world, and it's going to go up on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Target and all of those things. And then people are going to review it. And sometimes people compare writing a book to having a child, like you put your child out into the world. So to me, it's like, putting my child out in the world and then saying, do you think she's cute? Tell me what you like about her and tell me what you don't like about her, and put it on Amazon for everyone to read. And I talk about this a little bit in the book, I think, when I talk about overcoming objections, because in my brain, there were a lot of objections, right? Like people might laugh at you. It might not sell well. It might not get any reviews. It might get bad reviews. Like these were all of the objections that my inner, I call it in the next book, I have a whole thing on this, that one side was making, all these objections. And my job was to sort of choose something different. And the way that I did it, as I described in The Elegant Warrior, is to say, so what? So what if I get bad reviews? And I did. I got a couple of bad reviews. And I mean, they hurt for a minute and then you move on. So what if it doesn't sell? You know, it wasn't a New York Times bestseller. I would have liked it to be, but it touched enough people that I realized that it was meant to be in the world. And so every one of my objections, I was able to say, so what? And realize that I could handle it. And I think that that's a really helpful thing to do when you're afraid to do something, to say to yourself, well, so what? Sort of like, what's the worst that can happen? I coached someone yesterday on this and we worked out the worst that could happen. And it really, she didn't come up with anything that she thought was that bad. And it makes it so much easier to take those risks. I'll give you a sneak peek too into the next book. So in the next book, I give you these 10 tools of an advocate. And I talk about your outer jury. So for you guys, your outer jury are your clients, your customers, your team at the office, your children, your spouses. They're anyone that you want to persuade and influence. And in the next book, you use those tools to persuade and influence your outer jury, but you also use them on your inner jury. Now, when I say that, most of the women I talk to think that the inner jury is the part of them that's critical. But really, a jury isn't there to criticize. It's just there to listen and to choose. And so you want to give your inner jury other options other than the fear. So when I had the fear that the book would do terribly, I also said, well, it might sell really well, you know, and then I chose to believe that instead. My inner jury chose to believe that instead. And that choice makes all the difference. So I hope that's answered your question, Nikki, but I have those moments all the stinking time. And when I do, I really work to help my inner jury make the choices that serve me best.
Yeah, thank you. Because being a lawyer, like you said, it's one or the other outcome that can be very mentally defeating, but you had a great outlook on it. So I'm impressed. Thank you, Heather.
Thank you. Believe me, great outlook some days. My best friend would tell you that it wasn't so great some days when I was like freaking out. Somebody, Jocelyn asked, did you learn the idea of asking questions from being a trial lawyer? Absolutely. So again, from the next book, I tell the story that when I tell people I'm a trial attorney, most of the time someone says, oh, I should have been a trial attorney. I'm really good at arguing. And I get that idea. But the truth is, I only argue for the smallest fraction of my trials. The beginning of my trial is an opening statement, and we can actually get in trouble if we argue. The end, the closing, is a closing argument, but that's only a small fraction of the case. All day, every day, the rest of the trial, all I do is ask questions. I ask questions of my witnesses to build connections and build credibility and show curiosity. I ask questions of the opposing witness to challenge them and knock down their credibility. And so I think questions are magic. And I know that anyone can use questions to advocate to win. Michelle says, somebody had their hand up. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's two. There's Ariel has her hand up, and I know Lisa does as well.
Oh, Ariel, go ahead. I'll start with Ariel and then I'll go to Lisa.
Thank you. I have 2 points. I'm sorry. One, I want to say I love your chapter on show it till you grow it. And the point about that is I was a person that said fake it till you make it at times, but I love that you focus on show it, because we have all that we need already. It's a matter of applying it. So that chapter, really like love that chapter. And then the second part I wanted to ask, if you could elaborate more on like the patient's preparation and the 3 P's in which you probably focus on in your second book, but I like struggle with that because I'm great at like supporting other people, but I always wonder like how could I build the courage to do that for myself?
Yeah, it's so funny because the 3 P's I do focus on in the other book, and when I was prepping for today, I actually marked that page. So the next book is all about advocating for yourself, because there's all kinds of studies. In fact, there's a really interesting study out of Harvard that says that when women are negotiating on behalf of someone else, they're actually as or more likely to lie than men are. But when they're negotiating for themselves, men are much more likely to lie. Now, I'm not encouraging any of you ladies to lie, but I do think that you should always be willing to do for yourself what you're willing to do for someone else. And if you're willing to bend your ethics and lie for someone else, then you certainly should be willing to do it for yourself. And I always say you write what you want to most learn. I was the worst at this. I mean, for 20 years, I've advocated for people in the courtroom and yet would be terrible at advocating for my own raise or advocating for help at the office or advocating for the freedom that I needed to do my other things. But I think that in the next book, I go deep on how necessary it is that you realize that no one can do it better than you can. Ariel, no one else has your passion, your experience, your strengths, your talents, your knowledge, all of the, your heart. And so only you can really do it the way that it needs to be done in order to get what you want. So I think that, you know, in the next book, I dive deep. And one of the major P's that I think should be focused on most when you're doing that is perspective. Realizing that you're seeing things through a certain perspective, that you can change your perspective and change your life. And you can also change other people's perspectives. That takes some work. Changing other people's perspectives is not easy, but it is possible. And you do it with the tools of an advocate. And then the last thing I'll say is, it's funny because right before this, I recorded for some of my clients, I do private podcasts that are like specific to them and using these advocacy tools. And I recorded one of those for a group of medical residents in training. And we talked about show it till you grow it, because for doctors dealing with patients, there are studies that show that if they start to show their compassion from inside, even if it doesn't feel real, you know, that idea of fake it till you make it, they actually get so much feedback from the patient and the team that they become more compassionate. So I think it works for all of us. And I think that if you recognize that you have exactly what you said, Ariel, you have what you need inside of you and just find it. It might be just like a little spark, but as you show it to the world, it gets the oxygen and the air that it needs to grow. I love that chapter too.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. Lisa, your hand is up, I see. Oh, you're muted. There we go.
So I was going to talk about the complaining, and it really goes right into the perspective. So in our office, we say, you know, don't come with a problem unless you come with a solution. And what I think is interesting is on this call, we have so many insurance carrier personnel. So we have managers, we have underwriters, we have marketing reps, and then we have agency team members, agency principals, and we all work with different vendors and we're all picking our clients. So the perspective was one that resonated, but also then like how you pick who you work with and how you picked your juries. So that was something that resonated with me in terms of the industry we work in. There's so many different perspectives, and choosing who we work with is so important, because we all know that there's, you know, great people at what we do and people that we align with better. So those are the parts of the books that for us, for insurance, I thought really matched up well.
So it's really,
I don't know if that's a question, but
it's great. And I can speak to a couple of things. The picking people thing, I actually, I will try and dig it up for the next time that we meet. I actually did a whole webinar on picking people. And I had as my guest, a jury trial consultant, a guy who helps lawyers pick juries. And because there's certain tools that we use to pick people that will help you hire and make sure that, you know, you're paying attention to body language and tone of voice and all of the things. And those are all laid out in the next book as well. But I do think it's really important when we can to choose our juries well. And then to your point, Lisa, you can't always, right? Like the agents, the team, the people, I mean, you can pick your team, hopefully, but the other teams that you're dealing with, the other carriers that you're dealing with, the entities that you insure, all of those things, you can't always choose. And then the power of being able to see things through another's perspective. So, you know, as an attorney who represents doctors, one of the biggest challenges in the courtroom is every single person in the courtroom, including the judge and the doctor, is a patient. Every single person in the courtroom sees the world from a patient's perspective. And I have never in my 20 years of defending doctors had a doctor on my jury. And so no one naturally sees the world through a doctor's perspective. And my job is to change their perspective so that they can see the world through the doctor's perspective. But one of the things that I know for sure is that you can't change someone's perspective unless you understand it. So part of the work is getting to understand the perspective of your jury, of the people that you work with. How do they see the world? And in fact, I will, this is fun and a little bit interactive. So I want you guys to look into the green light as if you're looking at me, right? And snap 5 times with your dominant hand and then draw a capital E on your forehead with your finger. Don't think about it too much. Just snap 5 times with your dominant hand and draw a capital E on your forehead with your finger. Okay, I saw Alyssa do it. I saw Nikki do it. Michelle, I see you. All right. So you guys may have noticed as you were doing that, that there's two ways you could have drawn the E, right? You could draw the E like this so that you can read the E, like from inside yourself, or you could draw the E like this so that I could read the E looking at you. If you draw the E so that you can read it, that's fine, but you're seeing things from your own perspective. You're not thinking about the other person's perspective. If you draw the E facing me, you're a really good advocate in this moment because you're seeing the world from my perspective. This is a study that I read about in the book To Sell as Human by Daniel Pink, which I highly recommend. Phenomenal book. And it's funny because I read that book on vacation with my mom and my sister. And my mom, my sister was on vacation for the first time since she had had children. My mom and my sister and I go away often. Like a vacation in the spring. And so as soon as I read it, I put the book down and I turned to my mom and my sister and I said, snap five times with your dominant hand, draw a capital E in your forehead with your finger. And my mother drew the E facing me. And she's one of the most empathetic, compassionate, lovely women I know. My sister drew the E facing herself. And I was like, of course, because she's a pain in the ass. But the truth is that in that moment, it makes perfect sense that all she was thinking about was her next margarita and her next nap. And this perspective thing changes. There are studies that show that the more powerful you get, the harder it is for you to see the E from the other person's perspective. And so this is a great exercise to practice. You know, with the private podcast that I do for healthcare providers, and I also do one for real estate professionals, I recommend, like, as you put your hand on the doorknob to interact with a patient or a client or a prospective sale for the first time, picture that E from their perspective, because it will just ground you in how do they see the world. And once you understand how they see the world, you can get a whole lot closer to changing it.
That's great advice for so many of us that interact in so many different ways in the same world. So yeah, that's great.
Because you're dealing with so many different perspectives, right? Like you've got the perspective of, and I think so many of us are, you know, you've got the perspective of your support staff. You've got the perspective of your biggest client. You've got your perspective of all of the different people that report to you. And so to be able to see things through their perspective, it sounds exhausting, but there's actually studies that show that the better you are at this, the less you're likely you are to burn out, because your sort of compassion fills our cups. And perspective to me is the precursor to compassion. I want to make sure I get the questions in the chat. Michelle says, how can I apply these tools to being a marketing rep as well as a wife and mom? Thank you. I mean, listen, I think that every single tool in here can be used in any aspect of life. This is why, you know, again, I'm giving you a lot from the next book, but I always say you advocate every day. Advocate is simply to publicly support something. So if you tell somebody you've got to eat at this restaurant or you've got to watch Game of Thrones, you're advocating for Game of Thrones. And so what you want to do is do it effectively. You want to be able to ask for what you want in a way that makes you most likely to get it. And so all of these tools, whether it's overcoming objections, as a mom, your child might object to the curfew you gave them. As a manager, your employee might object to a new system that you're putting in place. And then asking questions and being curious. I will share, because the reason I share this is because every single audience I've ever spoken to, after I tell this story, someone reaches out to me and says it was life-changing. So you've read it, if you've read the book, but I'm gonna repeat it. I was an anchor at the Law and Crime Network during the Larry Nassar hearing. Larry Nassar is the gymnast doctor who was accused of molesting all those girls. And Judge Rosemary Aquilino was the judge. I had never heard of her, never seen her before. And the trial, the hearing, was meant to last only one day. We had a sort of allotted Monday because only 10 women were coming forward and most of them didn't want to use their names and faces. And that doesn't make for very compelling television. By the end of that hearing, though, over 100 women came forward and told their story, and most of them used their names and their faces. And I watched this and was amazed by Judge Aquilina and truly believe that the reason so many women came forward was because of the way she handled that hearing and the question that she asked those women. Because as each woman stood up to speak, she didn't say, why are you here? She didn't say, what happened to you? She didn't even say, tell me what I need to know. She said, tell me what you want me to know. She gave them the power. And in doing so, everyone told a different story. Like some women talked about how it impacted their kids. Some women talked about how it impacted their parents. Some women talked about how it impacted their careers or their sex life or their spouses. They all told what they wanted her and the world to know. So I reached out to Judge Aquilina afterwards. I interviewed her for the book. I had her on my podcast. She makes a little appearance in the next book as well. She's become a good friend. But I think, Michelle, that is a question that as a marketing rep and a wife and a mom, you can use that. It's actually a request, right? Tell me what you want me to know to change your relationship with anyone in your life. It's really, really, really effective when you use it. Jillian, you like the curse of knowledge. I love the curse of knowledge too. It's like, it's one of those things in the courtroom that I see all the time because doctors have the curse of knowledge and the attorneys most of the time do too. And so they'll get up and start talking about osteomyelitis and I'll see the jury's eyes go like all big. And they're like, I told these lawyers, I don't want it. It's not supposed to be on this jury. I don't know anything about these things. And then I'm at an advantage because then I'll get up and talk about bone infection as opposed to osteomyelitis. And all of a sudden the jury's like, oh, she gets me. I'm gonna listen to her. And that's really effective. So the curse of knowledge is something that if you can overcome it, you become a really strong advocate. Kamal, I hope I'm saying that right, says, thank you so much. If you had the option to add another chapter, a piece of advice in the book today, what would it be about? Well, it's a great question. And it's why I wrote the next book, right? Because you finish a book, and then you learn and you grow and you read more and you have more experience. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I have more to say. I'm hopeful that that doesn't happen anytime soon for another book. But so right now I feel pretty well settled. I mean, that said, you know, there's always more to add. Like in the next book, one of the tools of an advocate is argument. And it's the last tool of an advocate because I believe that it's very difficult to win arguments against someone. You know, if I'm fighting with you, and you have a very strong opinion on something, and I have a very strong opinion on something, it's not really likely that I'm going to change your perspective. Arguing. I might change it with questions. I might change it with credibility. I might change it with words. I might change it with perspective. I mean, there's all kinds of the other tools. So I think argument is best when a third party is deciding. But that chapter is kind of short. And there's more I think I could have said. You know, after you write a book, you do the, so I have an audio book. It probably won't come out the same day as the book because it's still in editing, but you do the audio book afterwards. And as you're reading the book, you're like, oh crap, I forgot to say this. Or, oh darn, I wish I could have just add this now, which they don't let you do, by the way, I've tried that. So I would probably give a little bit more about argument, but I think that with the new book coming out, I feel pretty much like the things that I want to share most to help everyone, every single one of you, advocate for what you want and get it, are in these two books together. Oh, there's more messages. Let's see. Learning to advocate and be heard is so important, but women don't do this well for ourselves. That's absolutely right. So much better at doing this for others. That is, Jocelyn, you could not be more correct. I mean, if we were as good at advocating for ourselves as we are for others, the sky would be the limit for us. And it's imperative that we learn how to do it. And it starts with practice. You know, it really does. One of the things that I do for some of my corporate clients is bystander intervention training. So I go in and talk to them about if there's bullying, if there's sexual harassment, if there's sexual assault, how do you, because bystander intervention, speaking up for someone, is nothing more than advocating, right? And the good thing about that is when you teach someone to advocate for the person next to them who's being bullied, all of a sudden they get better at advocating for themselves as well. And if we can get women to that stage where we get really good at it, it changed my life. I mean, I was no longer happy being a trial attorney. And now I feel like the work I do is the work I was put on this earth to do, you know, helping people to use these tools to ask for what they want and get it. And it never would have happened if I hadn't learned to advocate for myself. Michelle, you said that you have that question on a post-it note, so you remember to ask your agents. I love that. I love that. I think that it is a really powerful question. I'll share another powerful question. See, this is the thing. I sometimes forget what's in the books. I don't think this other question is in the book, but it's something I've read. It's a book called The Coaching Habit by someone named Michael Bungay Stanier. And it's 7 questions that he gives you to ask your employees and stuff as you're coaching them. And one of the questions is, and what else? And he calls it the awe question because it spells out awe. But it sort of gets you to, like, someone will say, well, the reason I did this was this. And then you say, and what else? And they answer and you say, and what else? And oftentimes people will come up with more. The first answer they give you is not always the real answer or the most helpful answer. And so that's another one that I find helpful. Maria, I think we all have trouble quieting that lizard brain. It's a problem. I mean, but it's there to help us. And I think that I love the way Elizabeth Gilbert, who's another author that I love, describes it. She talks about fear, which is your lizard brain. And if you're going on a car ride, fear gets to come in the car. You know, you're in the car, you being your elegant warrior self, your plans, your hopes, your dreams, your joy, your happiness, your contentment, everything's in the car. You don't leave fear behind. You can't. You know, it's not fear-free, it's fearless. You can't totally be gone with fear. You allow fear in the car, but fear doesn't get to drive. It doesn't get to hold the map. It doesn't even get to control the radio. It just sits in the car. And I think if you remember that your lizard brain, just sit there, you're safe, you're along for the ride, but you don't get to control things. I think if you remember it that way, sometimes that's helpful. Lydia, my uncle, gosh, I mean, yes, what a mentor he was and is to me. It's I was unbelievably blessed by having that experience. And you know what's interesting right now in the law, and you guys probably see this in your world as well, maybe not to the same degree. So as a young lawyer, I would work with John, and you read about it in the book. We'd be at the office for all-nighters all the time. Not my favorite way to practice, but that's how he practiced, right? And so we'd be there all night. And then as I got older and no longer worked with him on cases, but had my own cases, I'd be with doctors preparing them until late at night or early in the morning. And these days, I've talked to a lot of male lawyers who really worry about that, being with a woman alone in an office at night. And so I think that in that respect, sometimes we lose the opportunity at mentoring. Like, John was my uncle, but not everyone knew that. We had different last names, but still, you know, whatever, it wasn't a problem. But I think these days it can be dangerous, right? And even if it's not dangerous, many men are too afraid to do that. And there's something lost there. I think it's worth it. We don't want anyone to get themselves in trouble. But I think we need to more strategically seek out mentors and to make sure that not only in the seeking, but in the implementation of the relationship, that you're finding opportunities to be mentored. And I think it's as easy as asking. I have a mentee at the office who I tried a case against a man who she was his law clerk. And after the trial, she came up to me and she said, I want to learn from you. Will you be my mentor? And I said, sure. And we became friendly and I would take her to lunch. And then she came to work at my firm. And now she's one of our associates at the firm. But I think that asking is a huge way. I think that if you're in a position to mentor someone, to start doing it without even calling it that, so that they can sort of see what that experience is like, is also, you know, a great way of paying it forward. And I definitely think that mentoring is invaluable for both sides. I learned so much from that mentee. You know, she's got so much energy. She knows about technology, so many things that I would not otherwise have. Jillian asks, would you say over time that the experiences in your male-dominated field changed and get better? Yes. It's interesting. I think that it's getting better. So a great way to describe it is less than 5% of trial attorneys are women, for reasons that I've already described, right? Like, it's a very difficult job to have kids and stuff. And then a lot of the doctors who I represent are orthopedic surgeons, and a very small percentage of them are women. And so I had male clients and male colleagues. And I think that, I don't know about trial lawyers, like, more and more women are going to law school, but I don't feel like, and I might not have the data right, but in my experience, I'm not seeing more and more women as trial attorneys. But I think it will happen. I do believe that in medicine especially, it's a really interesting thing, because as more and more women become doctors, the male doctors have no choice but to treat them differently, you know, because now they're like, they're dating them, they're marrying them. It's almost like they're surrounded, and they're also seeing, that's a perfect field to give as an example. There's data that shows that women make better doctors. You know, they're more detail oriented, they're more likely to follow guidelines, they tend to be more compassionate, patients feel more comfortable talking to them. And so men are realizing that they have a lot to learn from women. And I think that's true in the courtroom too, Jillian. It's just gonna be interesting. It's got me thinking, because so many women that I dealt with as a young lawyer would act like men. You know, like they would be tough and a little bit angry and a little bit aggressive. And I had a reputation of always being smiley and extremely nice to the patients. I have a mantra that I may have to take a patient's story, but I will never take her dignity. And so I was very proactive about being kind to the people, you know, that I would take their depositions, to the point that one of the attorneys said to one of the his clients one time, Heather will act like she's your friend, but she's not.
Well, I mean, that's what the story was, where you got to do it elegantly, where you need to do your job, but yet at the same time, keep the respect people. It's just funny. I went to an engagement party this past weekend, and it was my friend that's getting married. She just finished her residency in family medicine. And so everybody that was there, with the exception pretty much of me, they all knew each other from being residents and all dating each other, because it was like women and the men, and they all met because they're around each other all the time, and they're all dating, and they were talking about, you know, taking different shifts and what it's like to work together and that environment. So it kind of resonated with me that much more recently. So
yeah, it's, you know, I think that there's power in our differences. That's one of the stories I tell in the book too, about my voice being different. And, you know, that's the case where everyone in the case was a man except for myself. And it was a really boring trial. It was a tough case. The man sued for failure to diagnose skin cancer. And, but it was about the doubling time of cancer cells, and the jury kept falling asleep. And they would wake up every time I spoke. There was like 8 attorneys and 8 clients in the room, and I was the only woman. And they weren't waking up because I was smarter or that my questions were better. It was just that my tone of voice was different. So they'd hear like, male, 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 female. And so in that, they would wake up. And so I used that difference, right? I decided to hit them with my best evidence as soon as they woke up, and then sort of get boring again as they fell back to sleep. I think that our differences are our greatest strengths. And so I do think that things are changing, but I still think that you can use your difference as your greatest strength. Ariel said, I know I'm faced with this, and I feel like in my life, I know many people who are too. It's identifying red flags in order to protect ourselves. Encouraged not to look for objections as they will come to us. Yeah, so it's funny, Ariel, because I think that some people are always looking for objections. You know, they're always looking for a fight. They're always looking for something to have a problem. They're always looking for a complaint. And those people don't need to learn. They need to learn to stop looking for objections. Now, there's other people that need to learn how to object. And it sounds like you are more that person. So am I. You know, I lean towards optimism. I lean towards letting things go. And so I had to learn to object. I tell that story that in the courtroom, I was like a whack-a-mole. I was like up and down and up and down until the judge told me it was okay to object. And we have to object in life when people don't tell us it's okay to object. There's a quote, I'm going to find it. I just included it in this private podcast I was working on today. And I think that this might be helpful as you think about this, because for those of us who are reluctant to object, it could be helpful. It's from a man named Jaya John. He's a former professor of social psychology at Howard University. And he says, your boundary, so it's talking about boundaries, which is like where you object, right? And he says, your boundary need not be an angry electric fence that shocks those who touch it. It can be a consistent light around you that announces, I will be treated sacredly. And I think that we think about our objections as like, boom, 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 like fight and warrior, right? Like, get out of my way and my boundaries are strong and you can't come in. And I do think that for me, if I think about it as like this aura, right, that I'm protecting my energy, and it doesn't have to hurt you, but you're not going to hurt me by coming in, that can be helpful. Do you have any recommendations for team building? Oh, gosh. Yes. it's funny because if you haven't read or seen Amy Edmondson's work, she's E-D-M-O-N-D-S-O-N. She is at Harvard and she wrote a book called Teaming, which is like, don't tell her I said this, but it's dense. You know, it's a good book, but it's like a dense read. She also has a TED Talk, which I think is phenomenal. But I think that what people have taken from her work is this term psychological safety. And there's all kinds of research, and Google has done similar research that shows that psychological safety is what makes good teams. And psychological safety comes down to really everyone on the team speaking as much as everyone else does, so that there is true like equality in speech. There's a great study that shows that in the operating room, if everyone knows one another's names, complications fall by 25%. And that's because once someone speaks up once and says, my name's Heather, they're more likely to speak up again and say, I think we might've hung the wrong drug, or, you know, you cut off the wrong leg. And so psychological safety is this idea that everyone on the team feels heard, feels seen. And I think that e-exercise is helpful there, right? To see some things from everyone on the team's perspective. And there's all kinds of exercises that you can do to increase psychological safety. That's part of, that's described in Amy's work. But I think that part of it is also recognizing that you're on a team. There's another, I know I keep referring books to you guys, but this one is a skinny one and it is phenomenal. It's called The Leader's Brain. And it's all about the neuroscience of your brain when you're leading. And there's a chapter on teaming in here that's also phenomenal that I'm incorporating in some of my private podcasts. So that's some resources, if not some good answers, Maria.
So many great questions.
I knew there would be. I knew there would be, Lisa. When we were talking about this, I'm like, all we got to do is warm them up a little and it's going to be a great conversation.
Yeah, I feel like the chat, we just need to be in person, right? Like, this is amazing. It's so nice. Thank you for letting us hear your voice. It would be great. I can't wait until we're all together. I could ask a million more questions, but we have time for one last question. If anyone has anything, raise your hand, alt Y, or go in the chat box for one last question for Heather. I mean, really, there's so many things to keep, we could go on and on about. I have one last question if no one else does, but so I know there's, when you think back to now, you kind of have had this career and you're continuing on in your career, is there anything you would have said to your younger self to persevere without being as burnt out, but also how do you continue to persevere without being burnt out, but accomplish all you have? I think it's a balance. You can't, you know, you don't want to accomplish nothing, but you don't want to burn out. So is there any advice you would have kind of stepped back and said, this is, would have been, you know, something I wish I would have taken to heart younger?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, Lisa, because I think I did burn out on being a trial attorney, you know, and I look at other trial attorneys who are still practicing full time, and I'm still practicing, but not a lot. And I take it so personally for the doctor that I couldn't do it less. And then I got to the point where I ended up in the emergency room twice with hives in my throat because I was so stressed out about the trial. So I think that sometimes you go through phases. You know, I wish I hadn't burned out. I wish I hadn't ended up at the emergency room, but I don't regret the change in career that brought me to. And then as far as advice for my younger self to maybe prevent that, there's two things. You know, I believe that you can choose your thoughts and you choose the way you see the world. And then what you see impacts what you think, impacts how you feel, impacts how you act, impacts what you get. And so whenever my inner jury is starting to think the thoughts that don't serve me, I consciously bring it back to choosing thoughts that do. And two of the thoughts that I'm choosing right now that I think would have helped younger Heather, one is easy does it. I think that when we sometimes think if it's easy, it's not, it's got to be hard to be good, or if we're not working hard enough, then it's that something's wrong or something's not being done right, or we're not reaching. I have found that when things are easy and they happen, it's exactly what's meant to happen. And all the years that I've put in of work and all the things that I've built have brought me there. So I think that it's okay for things to be easy and to sort of not always make them so hard. And then the other thought that I choose to think is I'm on my way. Because I often think like, oh, I'm not doing this right. I don't know what I'm doing. And so if I just say to myself, you're on your way, like you might not be at where you want to be with like building my team of my business or being able to get more business, more clients, all of the things that I want for my new business. And I just remind myself, I'm on my way. I will get there. And right now I'm just on my way. And if I had those as a younger attorney, maybe I wouldn't have burned out, or maybe I would have made this leap sooner and be further along on the path. But I'm very happy with where I am right now. And I think that the best is yet to come.
All great advice. Wonderful advice. And I don't know if you guys haven't, this is the first book I've read in a long time. I only made it through like the first third of Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In. Like this was so good. So if you haven't read it, you know, really, it's a great book. Thank you, Heather, for all of your time and advice. This, I'm going to kind of wrap up here, but I want, if people have more questions, Heather has her email that she shared with us, heather@advocate2win, which hopefully Jill will drop in the chat box for us. So if you have any questions that, you know, you want to reach out to her, Heather's graciously said that she'll answer them. I might reach out to you for one of the books you recommended. And as we talked about in this kind of discussion, there's obviously a second book coming out, which is Advocate to Win. And our fall event will focus on that book and hopefully in person be our first networking event back where we can all get together, meet Heather, meet each other again for the first time in, you know, a year and a half, and connect and kind of have more of an interactive event, again, with Heather's new book. So there's her book, Heather, correct me if I'm wrong, and maybe I should let you, but it's coming out. When's the deadline for pre-ordering?
So the book comes out, today's Tuesday. A week from today, the book comes out. If you pre-order it between now and then, anytime before the actual date it comes out, and send me, whether you buy it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever, send me a screenshot of your receipt to heather@advocate2win, which is in the chat there. I will send, my team will immediately send you a 10-part course that has videos and worksheets and some interactive community with the 10 tools of an advocate. So it's a $500 value. People who took that course and paid the $500 rave about it. It's free for the next week. So if you buy the book, just send me a screenshot of your receipt to heather@advocate2win, and my team will immediately, within 24 hours at the most, turn it around and send you a link to that course. And the course is free then, and it's also available forever to you. Just don't share that link with everyone, because then it doesn't really work.
and I just checked out online before here. I mean, the book's $27 on Amazon. So, I mean, the fact that Heather's extending this offer that the free course is there, I mean, is amazing. So if anybody has any questions about that or is confused, you can reach out to Jill or myself or Heather at her email. And, you know, that option's available for you if you're interested in the book for the fall. So, so I guess that's really it. Thank you so much for our sponsors and for the committee again. And, any questions on Women's Leadership Alliance? There's a lot of new faces on here. You could go to the PIA New Jersey's website. And again, Jill's probably putting it in the chat, but we'll also send a summary email after today with all sorts of information. So if you have any questions, reach out to us. And I genuinely hope to see you all in the fall.
Me too. Thank you. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, everyone. Yep. Thank you.